You're listening to the Friends Talking Podcast. I'm Joel Greenberg.
I was telling my wife about an experience I had in this online 3D world called Second Life. That's secondlife.com. Second Life is this, I can't say game. It's a virtual reality experience, I guess. We have 3D creation tools, a scripting language, and you can create anything you can imagine if you have the skill. Everyone has made up names, and everyone can change their appearance to just about anything they want. The company that creates Second Life is Linden Lab, so people in-world with the last name Linden are employees and are usually friendly and available for help. So I needed to go somewhere and do something in this world. I told my wife about how I needed help and how I turned to a Linden near me. But he appeared as a red devil, with red skin, horns, pitchfork, and tail. So, you know, I asked him for help. And my wife stopped me. A red devil. Yes, I said. So I turned to him and asked him to help. Wait, she said. You're telling me you're talking to a red devil? Yes, I said. Look, that's really not the point of the story. What could possibly be the point of the story? She said. After you tell me you're talking to a red devil. Well, she had a point. Now, why should anyone care about something like Second Life other than a few uber geeks? Well, I think it's because as a society, we're spending more and more time in video games in these online worlds, and if you only had time to learn about one of those worlds, Second Life should be that one. Why? Well, a couple of reasons. Unlike, say, EverQuest, Second Life lets you keep your intellectual property rights. Then there's in-world money. Yep, money. Money plus intellectual property equals an in-world economy. You can change these Linden dollars into U.S. dollars on these foreign currency exchanges on the web. You can make your representation of yourself in this 3D world, your avatar, into anything you want. Young, old, hot, not. Anything you can imagine. And it's social. Despite the culture shock at first, you know, Second Life really is about people. Economy, identity, society, copyright, culture. Understand these issues here and you're in a good position to understand them anywhere online, really. So I asked Philip Rosedale, the founder of Linden Lab and the creator of Second Life, to speak to the ad agency where I work about Second Life because with 130,000 subscribers who spend an average of 40 hours a month online, I thought we needed to understand this thing because it's a great example of its genre. I had also asked Athena and Athena Twin, that's their gaming tags or game names, founders of the all-girls gaming group PMS Clan, to talk to the agency about gamer culture as well that day. These are professional gamers who decided to create the support group for women in gaming after getting dissed for being women playing games like Halo 2 online. When I first told Athena Twin that they'll be speaking at a conference with Philip Rosedale, she said, "What do you do in Second Life?" As a gamer, she struggled with understanding an online world that didn't have a goal to motivate people to action like games do. According to Philip, the active user in Second Life spends an average of $1,000 per year buying clothes, vehicles, giving musicians tips, all kinds of stuff. There's so much money being spent, Linden Lab recently hired an economist to measure and understand the gross domestic product of Second Life. This stuff goes way beyond Space Invaders. I first met Philip in the bar at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin. He was the only one in the bar with a laptop open. We spent an evening walking around downtown, chatting about Second Life.
Typical night in Second Life, right? Live yeah. Music, you know? Look. So, we got people on stage playing live music, and we've got less than 100 people watching, right? Probably closer to 60, I'd say.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that really does work today in Second Life and is fascinating to watch, particularly live music, which has become very popular.
And so the
Fanwith connections are fast enough for live music?
Oh, yeah, yeah. What's... Rock over?
Yeah, tool out.
Yeah, what happens in Second Life today is that people are streaming 128 kilobit, high quality, live music into the environment, while which is, you know, essentially synchronized with what's going on. So you've got somebody who, we have people who play live, we have even people who play live together, which is a really interesting technical challenge, where they're not together in the
so
real world.
So they're physically in different cities.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I could explain that, but that there's a really neat trick they use to do that. But they basically play live, and their avatar is literally sitting on stage playing a guitar, and you are listening to this guy live. So I'll walk in, since a lot of people know me, you know, and the singer at the end of the song will be like, hey, Philip Linden's in the house, you know. And, I mean, that is an experience which is extremely special and unusual. But, yeah, the audio quality is fabulous, and people are dancing and coming there, you know, dressed up and you know, expressing identity. It's quite an experience.
So what's this trick that you're talking about, allowing two people at a distance to sync up?
Yeah. So we've had this case that it's been done a few times in Second Life. I think it's pretty popular, where there's a couple of guys who will play together. Like, there's a couple of jazz musicians that do this. And the way they do it, which is really unique, is they use a direct internet, peer-to-peer internet connection, and one of them is essentially kind of the source. And that person plays into a stream feed, basically. And then the other person gets his music, syncs to it. The first person essentially plays blind, as it were, or plays the acoustic, plays mute. Cannot hear the second guy, but the second guy can hear the first guy. So the second guy is able to sync to the first guy, and then from the second guy's home, the stream goes into Second Life Live to all the listeners.
So is that something you could kind of daisy chain for like a five-piece combo?
I have never seen it done with more than two, but it should happen soon. I don't know.
Well, if we heard it here first, walking down 4th Street in Austin.
First. The idea came here.
So... it's kind of disorienting, like when people first go to come into Second Life, because culturally it's disorienting and physically it's disorienting. Like, you don't move and you don't fly in the real world. So like, for new people, how can you? What kind of advice can you give them to kind of like get through that disorienting phase?
Yeah, you know, one of the things we used to talk about, or I guess one piece of advice I could give is just keep trying, because great things are invariably a little bit disorienting. I often, when we have despaired about how hard it is to get acclimated to Second Life, the thought has often come to me, hey, if you get off Grand Central Station and walk in the middle of New York, even if you've got a good map, a couple of phone numbers, and, you know, some friends meeting you somewhere, it's a pretty tough thing, you know. If you've never been there before, you know, it doesn't have a little pop-down catalog or categories of things to do, you know, that's well organized. It is a big place and you got to wander around. But that bigness is essential to its magic. The diversity, the complexity is essential to drawing you in a way that is real and long-lasting.
Okay, because there's a difference between the potential for all the complexity and there's like this physical sense of bigness, where if you're just flying around, let's say you got a basic account, you're just flying around, there's a lot of areas that are unpopulated,
right,
or sparsely populated. Like, what are the, like, how can people, it doesn't seem like the fine menu gives you a lot, or at least for me, when I'm on, like, what's going on now? Like, what can people do to find out what's going on and find out what their interests are?
Right. I mean, at present, you know, following the green dots on the map, we always joke about that, you know, follow the green dots, where the people are. You can see big clusters of people on the map, and of course that's, you know, that's where the minds are, and that's where the action is, and that's where you're going to have fun, and you're going to meet people that can help you get started. So one thing I would say for beginners in Second Life is to just open the map, find where there's a lot of people, and then go there and explore that way, rather than exploring, say, by the finder and looking at places that are statistically popular but not necessarily occupied with people at that time. So start with where there are real people so that you can talk to people and ask questions and get help. You know, one of the things that's so neat about Second Life is that because it's so difficult to get started, it's cool to give help. And so help is almost like a scarce resource. And so the giving of it and the getting of it is a sort of a ritual that is very pleasurable for both people. And so, it, you know, people hang around and they're more than happy to help you in a way that you just wouldn't find in the real world, because in the real world, we just sort of expect everybody to know almost everything.
So do you feel that you have the same or maybe more volunteers than an average volunteer organization?
Oh, yeah. I mean, thousands. I mean, a huge fraction of Second Life is at any time willing to help you out when you're online. I mean, if you look at the online population, there are, at any given time, I would say, you know, a sizable fraction, I don't know if it's, you know, more than 10%, but a huge number of the people who are online are really kind of there because they enjoy the helping. They enjoy the experience of acclimating people to the environment because it's just so pleasurable. I mean, we've all had that experience, you know, when you've done something challenging or difficult or scary, and you're sitting there recovering from that experience on that high, and then the next newbie comes in, you know, to jump off the high rock into the water, or, you know, to do something that they've never done before, and you're sitting there saying, it's okay, I can tell you how this is going to work, it's going to be fun. It's the same thing with Second Life.
So people really feel ownership because it's a special place, right? Kind of like how the Net felt in 1995?
I think people feel ownership for two really big and different reasons. One is that they truly do own, through the act of individual creation, that which they surround themselves with. So it is your house, it is your land. But there is a second thing that I think is less obvious, which may be more culturally important. And that is the fact that there is a very tangible realization for everyone that they are collectively participating in the definition and the pioneering of an emerging society. And that feeling of opportunity, that sort of, you know, why we all vote, you know, the idealization of voting is I make a difference. I influence the outcome. And that is something that is extremely tangible in Second Life in a way that, you know, obviously the real world is at a scale that it just doesn't offer to the individual.
So is there a danger as Second Life gets more popular and more people come into it of, here, we'll head back this way, of it kind of like the nest getting fouled?
I think that one of the things people always worry about, and I couldn't be any less concerned. I couldn't be any more. I share their concern for the future of the world. People worry that as Second Life grows...
Spoken like a real avatar.
I could be typing this. I'm not even a very good typer. People are concerned that as Second Life grows, it will come closer and closer to the real world in every sense, and that it will lose a lot of its magic. That isn't true, because underlying Second Life is a basic freedom of expression, of modification, you know, of the ability to express oneself and to change the environment and control the environment around you that cannot be removed by scale. When there's a million people in Second Life, the local area where you are will still exhibit these physical properties. It's kind of in, I hate to keep harping on physics, but it's in the physical law that it's different.
Which is my question. Obviously, you want this to go big. You want a lot of people there. And you've thought about how to keep this sense of creativity.
I think absolutely. I mean, to me and to us as a company, the thing that's exciting is the change that Second Life can make on people broadly. And what that means is that we're not going to be excited about, you know, a particularly special or elaborate thing happening in Second Life or reaching some sort of technology milestone. What we're going to be excited about is when there's millions of people using it, and then tens of millions of people using it. The thing that is interesting is the change that Second Life can have on human society broadly as people discover, hey, wait a minute, you know, I can use this type of mediated environment to do things differently.
Like, what? Can you give me an example of how that's really happened? How things that have gone on in Second Life have changed people's circle of friends, city,
right,
society?
So there are so many anecdotes, especially around the people who are really involved in Second Life, around learning. So people teach themselves social skills, and I can discuss them separately, social skills and job or real world skills that are unique and that they wouldn't have gotten to, so they say, in the real world. There's a great story. There was a guy who, one of the really long-time Second Life users, was in the forums one time, and he said, "Hey, I lost 60 pounds or 70 pounds in Second Life." And, you know, everybody, immediately the thought jumps to mind, wait a minute, doesn't the opposite happen? This is a person who is spending, you know, a huge amount of time, you know, full-time or more a week, you know, in Second Life. And so, you know, the conventional wisdom would be, you know, you'd sit at your desk and you'd use your computer and you wouldn't work out and you'd eat more and you'd actually go in the other direction. And yet this guy says, "I've lost, you know, 65 pounds or something." And everybody said, "Well, why is that?" And he told the most moving story. He said, "Well, you know, over this year that I had been using Second Life, you know, I realized one day that I had been making these iterative changes to my avatar, that I was always trying to make my avatar look a little bit better. I was always trying to change some aspect of it to better fit, you know, what I was imagining." And he said, "I was just struck one day by the thought, some time ago, I was struck by the thought, hey, wait a minute, I could make these same incremental changes to my human body by just exhibiting the same kind of intention. It can be done, you know."
Okay, we're standing on the corner of 6th and Congress. So if anyone ever models Austin, Texas in Second Life,
this is it.
They're going to model this. Let me give you a little orientation here. So that's the state capitol.
There it is.
Every now and then, you'll see it in movies as the our national capitol because it's cheaper to film here.
You know, when we look at a scene like this, like these two streets, and you've been in Second Life for a long time, you're always thinking how many primitives it is. You know.
So what would you say? What would you say?
Well, this is pretty high density. This is still a lot of prims. You know, we're only at 15,000 per sim, and you could do from here to the Capitol building a pretty good fidelity. You know, both sides of the street.
Uh-huh.
You know, the other thing you always give yourself to do when you're in Second Life is counting people. Yeah. So you can see right now, standing on this corner, if you just quickly kind of clump people, we're looking at less than 100 people in view.
Yeah, it's about 9:30 at night.
Right, so it's low density right now. This is not New York, you know, folks. This is not New York after work, but we're standing here at a major corner and we can see about 100 people. That's about where we are in terms of sustainable density in Second Life right now in terms of people on a server. But we can't go all the way up to that busy nightclub or Grand Central Station kind of feeling. And so it'll be interesting to see the technology advance. But again, we always felt like this would be enough, you know.
Oh, that's interesting, because Austin's kind of a mid-American smaller city. So the density of a smaller city, you think, is enough for all the social interactions to be continuous.
Yeah, else these cities wouldn't exist, right? So we're big enough to do San Diego or Austin or something like that, which is good enough to go, right? Good enough to launch.
Okay, so here we're looking down 6th Street, East 6th Street. There's the Driscoll Hotel. That's where we're staying. And that's kind of like where everyone parties. Now, there's like an age demographic. Everyone parties here in college. Like when you have kids and a family, you party over here on 4th. We'll walk around like 4th and a couple blocks away. And then here we'll cross the street. Down here, this is, don't hit us. This is South Congress. The river is kind of down that way. And the lights off in a distance are SoCo, the Continental Club.
SoCo? South Congress.
Yeah. The Continental Club, which is a really great club in Austin. Here, while we're walking.
And then Ruth's Chris. Every city has to have one. I'm sorry, you do too.
I know. It's the business district.
You know, franchises. Let's talk about franchises.
Okay.
Franchises.
What do you want to talk about?
So, do people bring will there be franchises in Second Life? Right. What aspects of the real world that are least appealing to us will be in Second Life? And here I editorialize a little bit.
Go ahead.
I think you talked about the long tail. I think one of the things that people ask us all the time about Second Life, gosh, you know. Are you guys going to let the Gap come in or let, you know, big brands come in? And I think that, well, first of all, people don't understand, or the people in Second Life, I think, do understand that we're not in control of that aspect of it. We're not going to, as a company, we really can't, at this point, force anything like that on people, nor would we, you know, in terms of...
Force or prevent? Like, there's two aspects of control.
That's right. That's great. So neither would we force or prevent such an action. So because Second Life is self-described, it has to be that way, whether you're a big media company or a brand or anything else. And so what I think we're going to see is experimentation where real world brands and products do come to Second Life. And I think some of those are going to have great success and some of those are going to have great failure. And I think that...
So what do you think the rules of engagement would be for success?
provide something that is genuinely meaningful and not dependent on economies of scale.
Which is kind of what franchises depend on to make money, right?
Right. In Second Life, an architectural, physical sort of rule of nature is that there really is no available economy of scale. And I think that's one of the things that's just so fascinating.
Why not?
Well, I think there are secondary aspects of it, like unions or, meta aspects associated to people power that you can potentially scale and get some cost reductions at large scale. But when you look at something like distribution muscle, the fact that you can, build a Starbucks store in a very, very efficient way by having built 1,000 of them before, that advantage just doesn't really exist in Second Life. Anybody can do that. So what is so unique about it is that it levels the playing field with respect to the complexities and costs associated with building this.
Because the cost of the physical world isn't there. You could duplicate a store like that.
Yeah, in a kind of a, exactly. I mean, and anybody can duplicate a store. So in a bizarre, and people do. So in a bizarre way, in a very enticing way, Second Life basically sort of democratizes the physical world. It redoes the physical world, but in a way where it is far easier for people to construct things at a lower cost scale.
Okay, so one rule of engagement is add value.
Right.
What else?
I think there's kind of a general think different sort of a motif to Second Life where, like we mentioned before, people have a sort of a whimsical, a what's new, I want to escape, I want to see the world as I imagine it kind of a nature. And what that means is that you've got to deliver something that is imaginative and clever and amusing and engaging in a way that in the real world we just, I guess, have a lower expectation for.
Those atoms just get in the way of creativity.
Yeah, exactly. atoms slowing us down.
Okay, so you guys have been sitting and thinking about this. What is, like, the most likely failure that we're going to see of, like, a big brand trying to come in? I mean, it's got to look to you like this asteroid heading towards the Earth. What's, like, the most obvious thing you think someone is going to do that's really, in retrospect, really dumb?
Well, I think if you look at something like clothing in Second Life, we were talking about that a little bit earlier. You know, what is so great about Second Life is that you can have all your clothes handmade. And so I have a very hard time.
Hand-designed.
Hand-designed, right. For you, in a way that's, hey, this is Torley's clothes, So in a way that is completely customized to your own behavior and your own intentions. I think that, brands, especially in clothing, often capitalize on the iconic representation of another person who's not you, repeated at a moderate cost for you to buy and wear yourself. And in Second Life,
the lowest common denominator, you fit in with all these other people.
Yeah, or the best approximation of an individual you aren't that you can afford, for $100. And I think that idea is just kind of gone completely in Second Life because, for the same sort of marginal cost, you can achieve a highly detailed and specific representation of yourself.
So what's the big failure then that you see coming?
Well, the big failure is somebody brings, a major clothing brand, doesn't differentiate it at all, from its representation in the real world, and just finds, that despite getting great, presence within Second Life and offering that product to everybody and trying to build an experience brand around it, it just completely fails because people are saying, no, I want something that says who I am, not who your star is.
Can you talk about what goes on differently in Second Life as opposed to, like, teen Second Life?
So Second Life versus teen Second Life, I don't think there's as much of a difference in behavior as people initially, when there was this enormous debate. Initially, folks in Second Life really did not want teenagers in Second Life at all.
Yeah.
And there was the audience and the users of Second Life are on margin a little bit older. I mean, they're older than people that play, like, RPG games.
So it's like the median age.
The median age in Second Life is 32. So,
and can you give me an idea of the spread?
You know, the distribution is actually really similar to the U.S. population curve. So if you look at it on a year-by-year cohort, there's more people in the younger years, but the tail into the older age range is so big that it balances out at 32. There's a lot, so there's more people that are older, basically. So the people initially really didn't want the teenagers in there. But when we launched Teen Second Life and we created a world just for teenager, we used to talk about this all the time. We'd say, what's different? And really not a whole lot. I mean, teenagers like to use, you know, automatic weapons more than adults. And I don't think that's very surprising. And so we see different kinds of crashes and stuff, you know, when we have to go in and fix stuff. A lot of times it's physical objects and gunfire and stuff in the teen grid, but that's about it. I mean, teens are landowners. Teens sell things to each other. Teens have events and parties. It's about the same.
So when was the point when you were thinking of Second Life that you said, oh my God, we could really do this, or I could really do this?
Well, that is a great question. I have been interested in and following VR and the generalized idea of using computers as a mediated space, you know, a synaptic space between people, basically, since I was a little kid. I was very, very into it. And I was also pretty entrepreneurial, so...
You mean as a little kid?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, I started my own company doing computer software development in high school and put myself through college doing that.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in San Diego.
And where'd you go to college?
I went to college at UCSD, University of California. So I was in high school doing database programming and building business database applications and selling them to businesses and then installing and putting in the network and managing all that stuff. So very into networking, very into PCs, very into just doing as much as you could possibly do with computers. And I was always struck by the fact that the ultimate place where all this was going was using the computer as a plastic medium, this idea. I just imagined, you know, standing in the darkness and making things in the computer. I think because I was very inventive and always imagining things that I wanted to make, but was struck by the fact, maybe because of my physics background, that, you know, atoms were pretty hard to work with, you know. Even if you were pretty good with your hands, it was hard to make things. And so I always was into this idea of using computers to make things. Watching VR in the 1980s and the 1990s, I was bummed by the fact that I knew the technology wasn't yet there. And that therefore there would be all these well-meaning failures where people would be trying to do the right thing, but the technology just wouldn't come along. And I think it was, as a young entrepreneur who had to, you know, pay the rent, I just sort of looked at it and said, it can't be done. And the thing that I think was unique about the approach that we took to Second Life was the realization that all new mediums start with novelty, entertainment, fun. People play with them because they don't yet trust them. And so whether it's blogs or podcasts or something like Second Life, people have to be able to play with and be organic with and experiment with and goof around with the medium first. And I think that the other thing that happened in the 80s and 90s was that people took that technology, the best technology that could be built, which still wasn't enough, and they tried to use it for business applications, which was just dead on arrival. So the realization that I think I had and then that we had as a company was that, first off, it had to be sexy, it had to be fast, it had to be game-like in the experience, and that what that required was pretty good 3D on a PC and broadband. And I was at Real Networks in 1999, and in mid-1999, a couple of things happened. One was broadband got to critical mass. It got to about something like 7%, you know, urban penetration in the United States. And we had seen historically at Real Networks that, like for 56K modems, when you got to that level of penetration, you knew that if it was a substantially better way of accessing the net, it was going to go to 100%.
Well, broadband now is, I think, at 30%, a third of all households?
That is for the entire, say, United States.
Yeah.
But in metro areas, you have a much higher sort of social tipping point that's been reached where everybody that can have it has it. And so your friends are very likely to have it. And so it was evident in 99.
So your friend sounds like one of the key components.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. So it was evident to me in 99 that it was going to go all the way, that it was going to get to that level of saturation in a few years. And I knew that building something like Second Life would take a few years. And then the second thing that happened in 99 that was maybe even for myself personally more of a catalyst, just as a kind of a techie, was NVIDIA released the GeForce 2, which was the first really fast GPU standalone graphics coprocessor. And that card was capable of rendering several million triangles per second. And I actually got one of those, and looking at the results on screen, and I said, oh, I think we can do this now. You know, I think what, at least what I was imagining, I felt could be done with that card. And in fact, that's still our minimum spec today, is the GeForce 2.
Broadband, graphics, you know, fast graphics, fast computers, and people.
Absolutely. Like you said, I think there was a requirement that the broadband saturation be sufficient that somebody could get their friends to come in. Because, again, the whole thing was going to work because of social connectivity, organic growth, playful behavior, and not something like, you know, government simulation or business ROI or anything like that. And that was what was different about what we did.
What are your dinner conversations like? Like, does your wife, is she there, or does she say, wait, what are you talking about?
I think my favorite dinner conversation, and my wife very much gets it, and it makes me, I think one of my favorite dinner conversations about Second Life is this is a place, I tell people, you know, at cocktail parties, the cocktail party starter is, this is a place that when you get right down to it and you dive in and you find out who the power players are, what you realize is this is a place whose structure and economy is ruled by women, which is really cool, who themselves make up a minority of the audience. About 43%, if you go online at any given point in time, as of a couple days ago, 43% of the green dots of the avatars are real world women. So it's almost gender balanced, which is neat. But that...
Wait, did you say 43%?
Right.
That is really interesting because that's the number of women who play games online.
Is that the aggregate number, I think? I think that's the aggregate including casual.
Yeah. It's just interesting how it's the same number.
Yeah. So if you see that, one of the things that's so fascinating, right, is that that is a minority audience that exhibits a majority control over the economy and the structure broadly of the society. So when you look at, like, the top 10 lists in any category, a disproportionately large number, say 6 or 7, will be women. And that's the cocktail party conversation that I just love to get people going on and then see where they, what do you mean? Or, oh, of course, I would have guessed it.
Just another data point that we live in a matriarchal society now.
Exactly. Or a validation of the fact that I think... early stage societies are very, very driven by social ties and structural topologies. And I think that...
You mean geography? When you say structural topologies, what do you mean?
No, I mean the networks of commerce and people that influence the outcome of the society. So who knows who? I think that there is such a sensitivity to that in early societies and at certain critical points in the growth of societies. And it is at those points that women have a very, very high impact on the societies because of the sort of stereotypically greater facility that they have in those roles. And stereotypically, what I would say about Second Life, and again, I say stereotypically because I'm painting with a very broad brush. Everybody's got every human has a real, you know, gender mix in them. So I'm not saying women do this or that, but feminine characteristics in Second Life tend toward this structure, economy, control, relationships. And it's just fascinating to see that what you sort of, again, stereotypically see is men being sort of the craftsmen of the environment, you know, making neat things like, hey, here's a really cool gun. And I almost imagine this prototypical scene that I know goes on all the time in Second Life, where the guy kind of brings in, he comes to the beautiful, powerful woman, and he says, look, I made this really cool gun. And she sort of says, that's very nice.
thank you. We'll put it in this shop over here.
And pat him on the head.
Yeah, pat him on the head. And why don't you come to this party on Friday? You know, and show it off. And I just think that there's something of an archetypical story that goes on there.
Which brings us to Athena. Amy Brady's her real name. And Athena twin, Amber Dalton, founders of the PMS Clan, and that's PMSClan.com. They're playing in a mini tournament, taking on all comers.
Down, sniper down. Do you want to move or hold it? I don't know where his partner is.
They're twins from San Antonio. Maybe you've seen them on MTV or G4 or read about them in Entertainment Weekly, Maxim, or maybe even Jane.
I'm down in the blue room, just lost sword. Coming up. Back up to the R. The sniper's over here. We can get him if we get that sniper. They're up top, coming over.
Up top where?
Oh, I died anyway. He's weak. One shot.
Right now, they're playing against two guys. Here's what the two guys sound like.
You know, they are much more vocal.
Yeah, they are. They're doing better. That's beating us.
Sword down. Got it. One's right there. You got him? All right, I'm going to go for the BR.
Middle.
Two. All right. Under BR. Under BR. He's running a library. Dead.
I will not deny I'm an addicted gamer. I'm gaming from waking till dawn.
That's Amy.
But still, I get my stuff done. My responsibilities are taken care of. If I have something to do, I go do it. Now, am I freaking jonesing and wanting to get back to my thing? Yeah, but I make myself do my priorities. You're going to be obsessed with a game and play it 24/7. I do that with every game I pick up. I literally play it till I beat it.
I've never felt the need to finish games. That's why I'm not a gamer. I'm missing the
gene. I just want to see the end.
Something's
the story,
missing.
And I want that feeling of accomplishment.
I love doing it.
I personally like sitting on my couch when I play, so.
That's Amber.
That's why I don't think PC will ever snag my attention.
Amber, they got a controller peripheral too for your
When I play, I'm laying down on the couch sideways, and I'm playing like this. And my TV's like a 54-inch, and it's all the way across the other side of the room.
That's another thing.
Gamers and their rituals. I'm like this. Sometimes I'll lay on my back and be like turning my head. But I love like being lazy. And, you know, that's my time to relax. Gaming is my time to relax. Oh, in Vegas, I didn't get to gamble at all because I was at CES, and I had like 14 girls there that we had to, we had several parties. Went to the Microsoft MTV party. We went to the Fatalities party, of course, every year we usually hit his party and he hits ours. And then we went to the Zip Davis party. All three of those were pretty amazing. But we were pretty much there to work for Microsoft 64. And it was just crazy. So I didn't gamble, actually, until
gaming industry for you. It's work all day and party all night. You don't get work done unless you go out, which hurts me because I am not a partier anymore. But you don't get work done unless you're at the bars networking.
But anyways,
sounds like a really hard life for you guys.
mine is hard. I work about a 60-hour a week job.
Well, my house is a little different. And I didn't want MTV there at all. I said that no matter what, MTV is not stepping foot in my house. But it is the quintessential, almost a frat gaming setup. It's, 108-inch DLP projector with one Xbox. Two more Xboxes in the other room, two more TVs. Whoa. In the computer room, it's my gaming PC, hooked to the 360, my old Xbox, a PS2, because my monitor is PC and video. It's a HD TV LCD monitor, 26 inches. And that's my gaming. And then we also have another Xbox and a TV in that room, and then another computer, and then you have my laptop.
Awesome.
So, okay, point fact here is it's like a gaming setup, but it's wires, it's networking, it's everything, And I didn't want them in my house. Like, we spent all of our money on tech toys and toys, and nor do we really care about like anything else, Except we painted the walls when we first moved in, and that was about it. Now,
MTV, my husband had taken them to eat at Morton's because he's worked there for like 14 years. So he had taken them because while we were finishing up, okay, MTV filmed us for 2 days straight. And then we're playing this tournament and it's all day, all night. It's really late. They went out to dinner. And what do? We've got all these people in town for this event, for this tournament. We all go back to my house. So there's 20 apes hanging around my house, hanging from the walls on every gaming system that we have, handhelds everywhere. Everyone's on all the Xboxes, all the computers. All everything. It's like all taken care of. All over. And then my husband walks in with MTV and I'm like, what the hell are you know, why are you bringing them to my house? Because it's a mess, you know, and I hadn't cleaned and because I knew all these gamers were coming over and going to destroy it anyway. And, you know, we're all just sitting there gaming. But they were absolute shock, absolute awe because, you know, we had been playing for 2 days straight. They had seen us gaming and whatever, da 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 da. And that was for in front of the cameras. I don't think that they really get, like, the gaming culture. And here we are after playing all day. This day and the day before and all night, we're sitting here in a house still playing. All of us playing. And this was where the real action was. It's at night where people weren't around and where we're all just going crazy and killing each other, you know? So they were so upset that they left their cameras. Like the producer, like I honestly, he was so upset, like he couldn't even talk because he was pissed at himself. Because he's like, why the hell don't I have my camera? This is the moment. And why the hell didn't we film here? You know, he just, it's amazing.
So what intrigued you about Second Life?
I'm just interested in the capabilities, the absolute customization that's offering in there. That's really unique. I'd heard about this game, I swear, years ago. Mumblings, talkings about it. And I assumed like it was more of a like a dating site. So I never like really looked into it. Which I'm sure a large component is. But you know, when I saw him demoing it, and that's really a key for gamers, they have to see it, they have to be exposed to it. That's the best form of marketing or advertising is seeing it. That's why like free demos are always should be on every game. Every freaking game. Because that's what getting it in. Just like on Xbox Live Arcade, you know, they already had the Bejeweled demo on it, but it only did one level.
Yeah, but this doesn't have a goal.
I know, but the community and social elements, right. And it does, exactly. You have a lot of goals that you can create in that game, whatever your expectations or what you're wanting to take out of it are possible. So, yeah, I'm looking at it like possible business opportunity as well.
Also the creative outlet.
And marketing aspects, you know. I'm marketing a girl gamer clan. These are a bunch of gamers anyway. And why not market to them about our girl clan? I'm always promoting the name.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how much fun is this?
I think actually when I get in line, it's going to be really fun. But I'm having fun just playing dress up. So this could be...
Well, everyone loves creating their character.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be the extension of themselves.
That's pretty good. I think that what it means to be is transactional. I'm really scared, though, how much time I'm going to spend playing.
Yeah, I don't want you to get into this. I know. She's seen me. She's been screaming at me. Get off that game! Because when I go into my MMO world, it's a completely different story.
I do all yatter. She's like, wait till I get back into town! Where are you?
I can't log out.
No, I mean on my game!
You know what? I just realized, too, if they Google this gamer tag, they're going to find everything about me.
Mm-hmm. Is that good or bad?
It's fun.
But online, freaks, I already have had, like, 2 stalkers.
Really?
Yeah.
How'd you get rid of them?
One was just a... Hello, he's whispering to you.
That's the bird talking to you. But if you want to just go into the mainland...
Yeah.
Which is where you're headed. I mean, you can keep playing. These are all these stations that tell you.
Oh, the bird's not real? It's
like, this tells you alt zoom. I don't know if you've used that yet. One of the most powerful things is the ability to move your view. Oh, this is cool. See if you can do this.
Kick the ball.
Actually, you can grab it.
How?
You need to grab it and put it on the table. That's the trick.
What did that sign back there tell me how to do it? Because I passed.
Click on that, it's the sign that's...
Oh.
It just made a new one because it got too far away. But you can click on it.
Click on it?
Mm-hmm. And then move it around.
Beach ball whispers? Wow.
On the table to win.
So what does all this mean? I asked John Beck, author of Got Game, How the Gamer Generation is Shaping Business Forever, to help put things in perspective.
I have about 30 seconds of them playing a game. Would you like to hear it and see what...
I would love to.
Going for combo, cover me. Where are they at? Where you at? Where you at? Oh, got it? Elevator. I don't see him. Oh, bye-bye, honey.
How military is that? I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, they've got it down to, just this verbal shorthand of, you know, how do you, you know, where they're supposed to go, how they're playing with each other, how they're responding. That's amazing.
Doesn't it seem that a lot of what we're talking about here is identity?
Yeah, I think exploring aspects of your own identity, it's experimentation of various kinds. And sometimes it's just putting yourself in the shoes of someone else. You know, I'd love a game, for instance, I just got back from Japan, I'd love a game that really made me feel what it's like to be Japanese day in, day out. That would be a really cool game for me. And I'm not sure there's a real Japanese part to my personality, but I'd love the experience of kind of seeing, wow, how does that feel to interact with somebody from a very Japanese perspective? The first and most striking thing in all of our research was they're learning really valuable skills in playing games, skills that will help them in the real world. So, you know, one of the lessons of Second Life is, wow, if you create a world for people to go inhabit, that's an electronic world, they end up basically doing exactly what we do in this world. And, you know, the skills from the real world are completely transferable over to the other one. And we found the opposite direction, that the skills that kids are learning in games are actually enhancing and augmenting their skills in the real world as they grow up. And it makes them more competitive. It makes them understand risk-reward trade-off, I think, at a deeper level. Business professionals who grew up playing games are actually report being more sociable. They're better team leaders. They make decisions in a more effective way, we'd argue. And so there was good news across the board on that.
You've been on now for 2 weeks since the last time we talked.
Yeah, it seems like, I think, is it only 2 weeks? Wow. Seems like a lot longer than that.
So what do you think of it now?
I'm actually pretty addicted to it now. I don't think I've touched my Xbox except maybe twice since I started it. So I'm trying to learn everything about it. It's easy. It's an easy user base. Again, I was a console player, so I didn't have much experience with PCs or the PC type games. So it's pretty simple in some aspects and still complicated in others for someone with new beginner knowledge. But the people inside the game are amazing, amazing help, and they've helped me learn it very quickly, actually. Some of the artists in this game are amazing. You've got some very skilled graphic people in here. I know a lot of people I talked to that created wonderful stuff really had no graphic capabilities or very little graphic knowledge before they went into here. So they're learning, and that's what I see this as. It's a great learning tool to learn different aspects of graphics. Well, let me tell you, we all went in together, and I've got some people that, I mean, I play every night when I get home. I've been playing, and I've got other people that play, like, straight up through the day, especially the ones that were graphically advanced. They really took off on this game. And they're loving it. You know, we're experiencing what it has to offer. You know, the whole first week, every night we went to someplace new to see what it had to offer. Experienced swimming, you know, I mean, going and dancing. I danced on a strip pole. So something I would never do in real life. I guess that's why they call this Second Life, right?
Do you want me to edit that out?
Oh, I don't care, no. That's part of the game. I mean, my whole point going into here was I wanted to experience what the game had to offer. Maybe it's not stuff that would interest me normally, or maybe it is, but I wanted to see, like, all kinds of different aspects. So you don't need to edit that I was on a strip pole. I was experiencing what the game had to offer. I wanted to see what the animations did and things like that. So, you know, that's a part aspect of the game that someone can enjoy. Dancing on a strip pole. I wasn't on there, but my husband was actually standing behind me. We go into this club, and he's like, "What is this?" I was like, "It's a dance club." He's like, "What are those poles?" I'm like, "Well, it's a strip club too, where you can strip." He's like, "Have you been stripping?" I was like, "No." He's like, "Well, why not?" And I was like, "You want me to get on the pole?" He goes, "Yeah, do it." So I clicked my character to go on the pole, And I wasn't up there but for, you know, 30 seconds and ching, $10 in my tip jar. So, hey, you know, I made $10, London dollars, on, you know, 30 seconds on the pole. Although I did get off really quick because someone recognized me in there. They're like, Athena twin? They're like, whoa, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, I better get off the pole. It's probably not the best representation for PMS.
So people recognize you here, even though you spent all your time on, like, Xbox Live, right? Or...
Yeah, you know, there's gamers of all types in here. So I wouldn't say there's a big community of FPS players, but, you know, PMS has had a little bit of more of mainstream exposure. So, you know, we've had some features out there where people will recognize it. Most of people don't think I'm the real one. And my online name is my character, my actual gamer tag, Athena Twin, and then the last name is PMS.
So what's it like, you know, going places and being recognized? Like, it seems kind of...
Well, you know what? In this kind of game, you almost want to hide behind the anonymity. So, I don't know. Like, how am I going to experience it, for instance, dancing on a strip pole if someone sees me? But, hey, you know, it's actually, I mean, it's cool, you know? It brings, you know, to light that there's, you know, real people playing this game. Some people are familiar with my picture from, you know, whatever. It was either Tom's Hardware or Entertainment Weekly, MTV, whatever it is. So they can see this and be like, oh, my God, look, there's a PMS clan member. You know, maybe they're not even familiar with myself. They're just familiar with the name. I wear my PMS shirt, you know, in the game. One of the helpers, when I came in, her name was Katarina Nino. She, as soon as I walked in, she was giving me clothes. And I was like, I'd really like a PMS clan shirt. And so I gave her the logo she had made for me in like 3 minutes. So I walk around most of the time in my PMS shirt. I made the character look as similar to me as I could in real life. So we stayed around on Welcome Island for the first 3 days, getting help from all the helpers, some wonderful people in there, learning how to move, how to build, how to change ourselves, you know, the directional, how to move in the directional path. I was having trouble with that at first. You have to press, like, Alt and just used to all of that. And mostly, again, learning to build, and then what was, like, protocol, how people were talking to each other, was it appropriate just to come out and just start talking to someone, which is really, really friendly here. Some people want to be left alone. They have their groups, but those people are very helpful. And most of the things I have fun with are the animation balls, which I think you've seen. So mm-hmm. You can do, like, salsa dancing. That was great. I took pictures of that the first time I salsaed. So I love salsa dancing. I haven't been salsa dancing in probably a couple of years. And then I was salsa dancing on the game, and the guy that had the balls that was dancing with me, he's like, he was saying a really cute quote. He's like, you know, Da Vinci painting behind the wall, $200. The different ball gown, $1,600. Dancing salsa when you can't dance in RL, which is real life, priceless. And I was like, exactly! How cool was that? What's hard to understand is why people spend so much money for a virtual life. You know, why would someone spend, you know, $300 for a house, you know, on virtual land, a virtual house?
So what have people told you is the answer to that question?
Well, it's not, I never really asked someone because I kind of understand that as I got into the game. I mean, I'm buying stuff left and right. So
why spend money in this virtual life?
Because it's fun. And you know what? If I was out going out to a bar and shooting pool and spending money, I would spend it because it's enjoyment. It's entertainment. That's what this is. It's entertainment. You're paying for entertainment. And, you know, if I want some fancy dancing shoes that make my character walk sexy or make it dance, whatever, if I want to buy a bracelet because it blings on the screen, you know what? It's fun. So I'm going to buy the bracelet. I'm going to bling. I'm going to walk sexy. And I'm going to dance also while I do it.
Anything in the world that you want to take out in the real world that you maybe you wouldn't have thought of?
Oh, my God. If I could just buy some of the clothes that are in this game, I would be in hog heaven. I am a woman, and, you know, I do love the shop. Don't get me wrong. So, you know, seeing some of the designs in this game, if these designers, someone would start picking these up and start making these, it has some of the best clothing designs I've ever seen. And because people are more creative here than they are in real life. It's like some of the designs here are outrageous. They're fun. They're funky. The prints are funky. I love, like, not norm clothes, and I love to wear in real life not norm clothes. So, the one shoulder drop offs that have like a certain texture in the middle that you just can't find this kind of stuff in real stores. Something like that, I mean, that would, someone should come in and make these designs in real life and have like a Second Life store of all the designs. I'd love it.
So, people are making stuff. Making friends, playing, making music, running clubs, in these computer-mediated virtual worlds. Some folks are making a living. What does it all mean? Well, at first blush, it's odd, being in a new environment like Second Life. But as Philip pointed out, any place is a bit disorienting at first. And maybe that's the real thing going on here. There's a there. Or at least it looks like a place. People look real-ish, or real enough. The experience is something much different than participating in a chat room because it's so real. Some people refer to Second Life as a lucid dream. Maybe the way to look at it is that these games augment real life. Looking at them as a substitute for real life is the wrong way to approach them. Here's what I mean. The evening of the conference, Philip had to be in an in-world talk given by the Stanford Law professor Lawrence Lessig. At the same time, we had all planned to go out to dinner after the conference. Well, we convinced him to join us for dinner because the restaurant had Wi-Fi, so he could connect while sitting at the table. So, as Philip appeared in-world, he was actually eating with us at Guero's on South Congress in Austin. As the conversation gained speed at the table, it was clear Philip wanted to spend more time with us than at the talk in Second Life. At the soonest appropriate time, he left Second Life, closed his laptop, and joined us in lively conversation. After dinner, we continued talking at the San Jose Hotel patio, a few doors down. Real life trumps Second Life. And maybe that's the message to take away. Real life trumps all these virtual worlds, but they can enhance our experiences sometimes.
Find out more about Second Life, go to secondlife.com. For more on the PMS Clan, go to pmsclan.com. For more on John Beck, go to www.nslg.net. The music you heard came from the Wired CD. More info at creativecommons.org/wired. The songs were DC 3000 by Thievery Corporation and Action at a Distance by Matmos. This podcast is licensed under a non-commercial, share-alike, attribution, Creative Commons license, February 2006. I'm Joel Greenberg, and I'm solely responsible for everything you heard. If you like it, why don't you pass this podcast around? Tell me what you think at friendstalking.joelandkaren.com. Thanks for listening.